Okay, I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for letting me come and spend 2 months here in Paradise and learn a lot of interesting stuff. And I'm also going to thank someone who's not here but who's also an essential person in getting me here, which is Paul Golbout, my next door neighbor in offices back in Urbana, who has very kindly taught my classes for me for the last 2 months. I discovered today that he didn't get the grades in, so I had to spend this part of this morning getting the grades in. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the PPUS IP superconductors, and the work here, I'm going to review some older work just to put things into context and talk about it from the viewpoint of someone who knows a little bit about superconductivity. The work that that's actually our own work, it was all done with my grad student, Seok-Bun Chung, who's sitting over there, so I will mention that. PPUS IP superconductors, this is what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to tell us a bit about what a PPUS IP superconductor is, and before I even start that, I'll tell you why we're interested in them. I'm going to tell you a bit about the edge states of these things, which are interesting, particularly to someone with an interest in the quantum Hall edge states, and then talk about what goes on in the vortices in these systems, and it's the vortex core states which are responsible for the non-abelian statistics. And what I really want to tell you is that thinking about the superconductor allows us to understand this fusion algebra that everybody has been writing down, which otherwise you need a fair degree of mathematical sophistication to understand, and also discuss a bit about the braiding, and in particular the Berry phase aspects of the braiding. And then I'll have some conclusions. So why are we interested in the PPUS IP superconductors? They're a class of superconductor which has been around in the theorist's mind for quite a long time. And a form of them have existed at least in three dimensions for a very long time and are associated with my colleague Tony Leggett, who's one of the people who worked out the theory of these things. They're going to be an analog of the helium-3A phase, which has quite a complicated order parameter. So the Cooper pairs have orbital angular momentum 1, and they're a triplet spin 1 pairing system. They have the feature that they break time reversal symmetry. And there really is a system which might well be a two-dimensional analog of these things. But before I talk anything about this, why are we interested in them as in the this particular quantum computing context? And I think the game here starts with the realization that they've got interesting topological properties, an observation that goes back to Grisha Volovic, and then was picked up by Nick Reed and Dimitri Green. And when I come to the references at the end, I think that's the first reference that I'll mention is Nick Reed's one. So we have an actual candidate material, which is supposed to be a superconductor like this, which is essentially two-dimensional. And I'll talk a bit about that as well. So the system is angular momentum L equals 1, and it's a spin triplet. And with any superconductor, what one's interested in is what is the object whose gains a vacuum expectation value or a ground state expectation value. And it's this expectation value of this operator which forms the order parameter. And so we have here two fermion fields. They're supposed to be real electrons in the case of the ruthenates, and they have an index here which can be plus or minus a half. This is the spin index, and they're sitting at two places, x and y, and we can't put them exactly on top of one another as one normally would for an S-wave case, because it's the behavior in the relative angle between the x and the y that tells us that it's angular momentum L equals 1. And for the particular phase we're interested in, the analog of the A phase, the order parameter factors into two pieces, one bit that has to do with spin, and another piece which has to do with the orbital angular momentum part. Other triplet L equals 1 superconductors have these two guys talking to one another in a much more complicated way. So you've got this guy here which has a vector D in it, which I'll discuss in a minute, and these two vectors E1 and E2. And D, in some sense, is the direction in which the spin is not. What you've got here is you can think of the Pauli sigma matrix as being a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient that couples two spin halves together to give a spin 1. And of course, it's not really coupling two spin halves. One of those is a spin half complex conjugate. And in order to turn that complex conjugate representation for spin a half, it's a pseudo-real representation. You need to turn it into the real representation so that these two guys are both spin halves, and not spin one of them being a spin half star. And you need the I sigma 2 to do this. So if you make an SU2 rotation on here and an SU2 rotation on here, you make an SU2 rotation on the D vector. And in particular, therefore, if you make a rotation about the D axis, it doesn't move. And that means that spin rotations about the D axis are a symmetry still of the system. It's not been broken by this order parameter. So the spin in the D direction is a good quantum number. Now, the E1 and E2 are vectors in real space, which get dotted into a gradient operator. So the combination of these two things becomes like a P1 plus an IP2, which is these guys here. And then it acts on a delta function here in a simple way of looking at it. It's some thing which has an x plus iy dependence on the angle. So the order parameter, if we forget about the d, is specified by these two vectors, E1 and E2. And I've drawn a little kind of purple plane here to indicate these guys in the real system live in the planes of the material we're interested in. The strontium ruthenate, if it really is a P plus IP superconductor, is a layered material, very much like the high TC materials. And these guys live in there. It means the Cooper pairs are moving around freely in this plane. L is going to be their angular momentum vector, and that can either be up or down, so you can have domains of up and down, and interesting things happen on the boundary where those arrows turn over. There's a rather nice picture of this from an article written by Yoshi Maino and his collaborators. These are the people who came up with the ruthenate material and first discovered its superconductivity, and they have this very nice way of looking at the order parameter. Here is our angular momentum vector again. Here are the Cooper pairs going around in some orbit, L equals 1 orbit, and they have a spin, and the spins are pointing in the same direction. So this particular green arrow is pointing in the same one as this one. The red arrow is pointing in the red arrow here. And this one has the feature that the D vector would be pointing also in the same direction as this guy. So the spins are in every direction except this. That's the D vector. So the D vector is the direction that preserves a spin. Now, I'm a theorist. I like to solve simple differential equations because I believe that you should look in the simplest possible place for things. And so it's worth pointing out that when I'm talking, I'm going to be talking about a theorist's Fermi surface in which we have kx and ky. I'm going to imagine that it's a nice circle here. Everything inside here is filled up with electrons. Everything outside there is not filled up with electrons. But the real material has a Fermi surface that's a little bit more complicated. It's in three pieces. This is a cover from our physics report, or Physics Today, a few years ago. I don't know who drew it. It's very pretty. But it points out that that there are three different types of Fermi surfaces in the real material. These ones here. There's this one, I think, which is the important one, which is the one that primarily drives the superconducting pairing. And then there's another. So there's three Fermi surfaces. And also reminds us that the real material is made up of a stacked layers of ruthenates. And the Fermi surface is pretty cylindrical going up, which means there's not much dispersion in the direction perpendicular to the plane, so the different planes are not interacting with one another very much. The electrons find it difficult to hop from one to the other. But it's still worth bearing in mind that when I'm talking, I'm going to be thinking always about a single layer rather than the real material, which is a stack of layers. So the system is interesting for various reasons. And a number of these reasons were originally raised by Grisha Volovic, who's kind of one of the driving forces between topology and superconductivity. And I think he was the first person to point out that the edge modes that run along here are analogous to quantum Hall systems, and they have this feature that they're Majorana-Weyl. Weyl is just a code phrase for chiral. We've been using the word chiral all morning. Hermann Weyl has Weyl fermions in neutrinos, and I guess Majorana-Weyl is what a string theorist would call these things. And it also has vortices which have half the flux of the conventional ones. And Those guys are the things that are interesting, and they have various features, one of which is that they're Alice strings, again, a word from particle physics. That's because the spin in the d vector direction is supposed to be conserved, but it's only conserved in local regions. If you move around in some region, then the spin will remain the same. But if it goes off in some large excursion and goes around one of these strings and comes back, it will come back pointing in the opposite direction. But in the center of these vortices, there are Majorana core states that I'll describe. And these core states have these properties of being related to the Ising model. So let's have a look at these edge states, because these are rather interesting. And there's a nice picture, which I'm afraid some of you have seen before. Those of you who are in the program, I've already shown this slide to, which explains both why they are chiral, or vial as I'm calling them here, or chiral, I've used the word there, and why they are Majorana. So one needs to understand, personally, why are there states which are trapped near the surface of the superconductor? So I'm making a simple toy model of the edge here. Again, a theorist model, but it captures the essence of what's going on. This is supposed to be the edge of the superconductor. The electrons don't get out here. I've got a little region where the order parameter is dropped off to zero. It probably does go towards zero, towards the edge of the system, but I'm just pretending it's exactly zero in some little region of some distance here. And then inside here, the system is gapped. And imagine that you are an electron, and in this region here, you're traveling towards the region where the gap is positive, and you've got an energy which is substantially less than the energy of this gap. You can't keep on going when you reach the gap because your energy is less than what you've got, what you have to have to be carrying on. And so you're going to be reflected from the interface here. And the type of reflection that takes place is called Andreev reflection. Sorry, I've forgotten what was actually on my slide. Well, let's talk about it here. So it's Andreev reflection. One of the nice things about Andreev reflection is that when you're reflected from the thing, instead of bouncing off like a mirror, you come straight back in the direction you were going. And the way to think about that is you've got an electron that's coming along here. It comes into the condensate, and it finds a friend, another electron, to make a Cooper pair. But when it finds its friend, it's snatching it from somebody else, and it's going to leave a hole, and it's got momentum k, it's going to find a friend with momentum minus k, so it's going to leave a hole with momentum minus k, but a hole with momentum minus k has momentum k. So the momentum of the particle doesn't change when it's reflected. It's coming in and it's coming back with exactly the same momentum, but because one was a particle and one was a hole, they travel in opposite directions. So the guy reverses its direction and comes straight back. But the Cooper pair in this P-wave guy has angular momentum equal to h-bar. And so this particle is traveling along. Usually it's got low energy, so it's close to the Fermi surface. It's got momentum kf. And in order to have angular momentum L equals h-bar, its friend, instead of doing what they normally do in an S-wave superconductor, do this. They've got to have some separation between them of some distance A. And it's going to become, the particle comes reflected back with a distance A apart such that KF A is equal to H-bar. And so when it bounces off here, the hole bounces there, does this. And it does some kind of intricate little dance, which is gradually creeping up the edge here. It sounds rather like a picturesque fantasy, but the thing that's nice about it is if you actually write down the differential equations that govern the motion of the particle here, you write down the Bogle-Yubov-Degen equations for exactly this geometry and calculate the speed at which you propagate up here, or to calculate the energy-momentum dispersion relation, how the energy is as a function of k, the momentum along the edge here, you get exactly the speed that's predicted by this picture. I don't mean just approximately that. You get exactly the right functional dependence for the speed. So the BDG equation is exactly describing this process, BDG being Bogle-Yubov-Degen. So it's the S-wave, it's the P-wave character, the fact that these guys have some tendency to go around, which leads to the edge waves drifting up at some speed that's related to the geometry of the edge. So that's why they're chiral. So why are they Majorana particles? Well, a Majorana particle is one that is its own antiparticle. And so let's think about what would happen in an S-wave spin singlet superconductor. There, the spin is an exactly conserved quantity because the condensate is a spin singlet. And so when a particle is being bounced back and forth, it's a mixture of a particle with spin up and a hole with spin down, so that the actual thing that's created by this or annihilated by that and the thing that's created by that, the net excitation has the same spin. So this is what happens in the S-wave case. So you've got up here and a down there. And so if you take the dagger of this guy, the annihilation operator to make the creation operator, take the dagger of it, you notice that this interchanges these, so it changes the direction of the spin on this. So the S-wave superconductor, the hole associated with the particle is not the same as the particle itself. But in the triplet case, provided the D vector is appropriately organized, here I'm thinking of the D vector as pointing in the Y direction compared to where these spins are pointing, then it has this feature that I'm writing and displaying here. Then when you write this down, these two guys have the spin in the same direction, and so when you take the emission conjugate of that, you get the spin in the same direction. And so this guy is its antiparticle with the opposite momentum. And that's exactly what happens to the annihilation and creation operators of a Majorana particle in two dimensions. Its dagger object is basically the same guy, but with the momentum flipped. Now how about the vortices in these systems? We know what happens in a vortex in an ordinary superconductor. As you go around it, the order parameter phase winds by 2 pi to make the order parameter single valued. In an S-wave superconductor, you don't have a D vector, but you can certainly have a vortex even in this system in which the D vector remains constant. And that's what would happen. So the combined effect of those two things is to leave the order parameter single valued. And the consequence of that, which isn't obvious from what I've just written down here, but if you actually look back at the order parameter and write down the equation for it, you see that both components of the spin see the vortex when it does this. But if you do a slightly different thing, you make what we call a half quantum vortex. Now the phase of the order parameter winds as you go around the vortex only by pi. So it's only half the amount of winding. So in order to make the order parameter single valued, the spin D vector also winds by pi. It changes its direction as you go around. And if you look back at or remember what the order parameter looked like, there was a phase of the order parameter chi in there, and there's the D vector. So if I wind by pi, I multiply that part of the wave function by -1, and changing the sign of this multiplies it by -1. And so the whole wave function comes back to where it is, and you have a single valued order parameter. And a consequence of that is that only one of the two spin components sees the vortex. So you can have spin up, thinks there's a vortex there, spin down, thinks there isn't a vortex there. And which component it is depends on which way the D vector winds while this one's going. If this one goes in the same direction as that, say it'll be the spin up one. If this guy winds in the opposite direction to this phase, then it'll be the spin down spin that sees the order parameter. Now there's a problem with that, which I should mention, which is, these are beautiful objects. Even in helium-3, people have been looking for them for a long time, and they haven't seen them. And there's a reason for that, which is that the D vector usually likes to point in the same direction as the L vector. So the L vector is sitting up out of the plane. If the D vector's up there, pointing there, it can't do this pi winding, and so you aren't going to have any of these things. So it's been suggested quite a long time ago that one can apply a magnetic field to break that up. That's what was suggested in the helium-3 case. And recently, Shankar Dasana and where is he, Tiwari? One of his co-authors has suggested also that we should apply a magnetic field to see these things in strontium ruthenate. Because an applied magnetic field in the same direction as the L vector, the spin would like to line up with that. That makes the D vector doesn't want to be in the direction the spin is going, and so it would be forced into the plane at right angles to the magnetic field. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to pretend that I've got a vortex which is only going to be seen by one spin component, and I'm never going to ignore the other direction spin. So I'm going to pretend for the rest of the talk that there's only one species of fermions, or alternatively, in the quantum Hall effect, that we would think of the fermions as being polarized. So I'd like to now talk about what goes on with bound states in vortex cores. If you're a superconductivity expert, this is going to be boring. If you haven't thought about it, it's quite interesting. So again, you can have a region where the order parameter goes to zero, because in reality it's going to zero gradually, and making a kind of slam bang model where it starts from something full size and then goes to zero. It's just a toy model, but it allows us to understand what's going on. And again, you have a particle who has too small an amount of energy to propagate freely outside here. Its energy is less than that of the gap. So it's going to come along and it's going to slam into the wall here, and it's going to get reflected. It'll be Andrei reflected as a hole. But unlike the situation we had before, the hole doesn't come directly back along the line of the incoming particle. And the reason there is that the condensate is circulating around the vortex, so the Cooper pairs have some net momentum. And so when the particle goes into here, the fermion goes into here and finds a friend, the friend doesn't have exactly the opposite momentum with which it forms a Cooper pair. The Cooper pair has some net momentum. And so there's some slight change in the momentum, and so the hole comes back slightly at a slight difference, bounces here, and so the whole thing, bound state, kind of gradually creeps around. And the geometry of that tells us exactly what the dispersion relation's got to be, at least under the circumstances in which we can pretend that angular momentum is a continuous variable. So because this failure of the Andrei reflection to be exactly retroreflective, this kind of core bound state goes backwards. And then we know what the energy's got to be, because we know that this change in the angle here, angular momentum and angle, are conjugate variables. The rate of change of the angle has to be given by dE, the angular momentum, and it's going to creep backwards at some frequency omega zero, which for this model actually is the speed at which these guys go around, the angular frequency at which these go around. And so there must be some L here and perhaps some offset constant. So even without solving any differential equations, just from the geometry, you know you're going to get a spectrum of bound states that look like this. This is basically the physics of the Carolli-Degen bound states. They found them by solving differential equations, but you don't need to do that. You can look at this. The question is, what's this constant? This constant is crucial for what we're going to do. And in order to find that, you actually have to solve some differential equations. So whenever you look at the differential equations associated with a superconductor, the Bogogubov-Degen equations, they have a feature that if ever you find an eigenfunction for one of those with energy E, there's also another one with energy minus E. So if we look at these states that are in the vortex core, so this is supposed to be space in this direction here, this is energy in this direction, here's a 2 delta energy gap, you're going to have some bound states trapped in the vortex core here. They have, if there's one with this energy, there's got to be one with minus energy, and so on. So this, you have a picture like this. And there are two possibilities then. One is that there's no state in the middle here, which is what I've drawn here. And that's what happens if you solve the equations for an S-wave bound state. This alpha is a half, and so there is no exact zero energy state. That quantity L that I was talking about before is an integer. But if you look at the P-wave case, then there's a bound state exactly at zero energy, right in the middle here. And this is the one that's of interest to us. And this feature has to be topologically stable. You can derive these equations and these bound states for having perfectly circular vortices, but you know that if you were to squish them in some sort of way, the E to minus E symmetry's got to be preserved all the time, and there's no way in which this guy can move off and you could gradually move into the other case without violating the e to the minus e symmetry. So this bound state, the zero energy bound state, is there for topological reasons. It has a topological stability to it. So what in order to do this, again, the way that you actually solve these equations is that you write out the bound states here in cylindrical Bessel functions. You make some approximation that the Bessel functions are multiplied by some slowly varying factors, plug into the differential equation, and you find that you get an equation for the propagation of a particle in one dimension. It's governed by a one-dimensional Dirac equation, and it would be along a chord like this. And what you'd be seeing is it would be moving with a mass which is proportional to delta. If you're thinking in a particle physics language, delta would be the fermion mass, and a phase that depends on the angle as you go around here. And then the bound state energy turns out to depend on the difference in the phase that the particle sees when it's reflected. And so down here, if you're bouncing backwards and forwards down here, you have an energy that's very close to minus delta. There's a very small change in the phase here. As you bounce across the middle here, there's a change of pi, because there's a 2 pi phase change seen by that spin, part of which comes from the change in the phase of the order parameter, and part comes from the change in the delta, the d vector, sorry. But there's a phase change of pi across here, and that gives you exactly a zero energy bound state. That's why you know that it's just L and not L plus a half. And then as you start bouncing across here, you get closer and closer to plus delta. And so one of the things that can happen, if you're sitting here bouncing backwards and forwards and the vortex starts moving in this direction, you gradually creep up in energy until the time that you reach over here, you would come out and you would have created a quasi-particle just through sliding the vortex. That's the origin of something called the Kirtland-Kraepsow force, and that's one of the mechanisms that produces friction in motions of vortices. That's not quite true, because of course this guy is actually creeping around in angle. It's not, while it's going like this, the angle is changing because of that retroreflection. And so it's a little bit more complicated. You don't actually produce quasi-particles, but what you do is you drive the quasi-particles in the vortex core out of equilibrium when you start moving it, and that's the origin of the friction. Now, why are these bound states Majorana, and why are they going to be interesting? So what you do is you find a whole bunch of eigenstates of the Bogoliubov-Degen equation, and their angular and radial dependence is going to look like this. I should say that I'm simplifying slightly here. There's two types of these half quantum vortices. You've got one, the Cooper pairs are going this way around, if the L vector's in this direction. And the vortex can have circulation going this way around, or it can have circulation going that way around. And in the case that it's going this way around, you have a factor e to the I theta, e to the minus I theta, where theta is the angle, azimuthal angle. And then the angular momentum, L, which has to be an integer, sits out here. If it's going the other way around, then these two angles are absent, and you've just got the e to the IL. But it doesn't make any difference. The situation's slightly different. There are two different types. The core states are rather different depending on which way the vortex is going, this way or that way. But as always, when you have a Bogoliubov-Degen equation, if you've got a solution with some energy, which has got a u and a v, then there's a solution with the opposite energy, minus e, which is made by interchanging the u's and v's and complex conjugating them. And the solution here with the opposite energy is the one with the opposite L. So these coefficients, the u's and v's that are sitting inside here, have this feature that u of L is v star of minus L, and so on. And that has a consequence for what this B is. Whenever you're expanding out a solution in one of these superconductors, the way that you get an equation is you pair up the electron or the fermion annihilation field and the psi dagger, the creation field, and it's these U's and V's are always expanding working in terms of these guys. So the top row here is telling us how to expand psi, and the bottom row is telling us how to expand psi dagger. And there's a consequence of that. There are consequences. All right. So here I've written out the same equation here. So let's focus on some particular L. So here's psi. It's got a B of L and an E to the I theta and a U. And it's got an E to the I theta and a V star, because I've written the one with the minus L here as instead of writing U of minus L, I've written V star of L, and similarly down here. So I get this from this equation. But there's another thing. This guy is supposed to be the dagger of that one, right? This is dagger this, I get that. But if I dagger this, I don't get that unless I have the feature that these two equations are the same. This is taking the complex conjugate of this guy, and the other one was using the two rows. So I had it cleverly done. So you bounce back and forth between the two, and so you see that you must have this relationship again. So these core states have a similar feature to the edge states, that the dagger of any particular mode is the annihilation operator for the opposite value of L. So it's a very similar equation to what we had before, except we had K for the edge momentum, here we've got L. And in a way, that's because really, what is a vortex? It's a little piece of edge. You kind of punched a hole in the superconductor, dragged it inside. It's a fairly small piece, but nonetheless, it's still an edge. It has the same sort of edge creation situation. But now we said that L equals zero is allowed, and so there's a special feature for the mode that sits right in the middle here. It's its own dagger. And so that's what produces lots of interesting effects. So how are these guys, what are the annihilation and creation operators commutation relations? It was derived those from the completeness relation. We know that the anti-commutator psi and psi dagger better be a delta function. And we know what the completeness relations of the u's and v's are. So you can figure out that b0 squared had better be a half, and it had better anti-commute with all the other modes and so on. And one of the things then we can ask ourselves is if it anti-squares to that, and it squares to something here, and it anti-commutes with everything else, let's call these guys gamma, because there are things called gamma that we know elsewhere which have that sort of anti-commutation relation. So these things were invented by Mr. Clifford at some point in the 1850s, and we therefore name them after Dirac. As I always like to say, it's not the first person to discover something, it's always the last person. All right. So once the famous enough person has discovered something, it's not going to be rediscovered again. So the gamma matrices, the Dirac gamma matrices, which of course have this anti-commutation relation, are called the Clifford algebra by mathematicians, because they know perfectly well that Mr. Clifford invented them. And they are the things, the B0s, these annihilation and creation operators in the vortex core, are not really annihilation and creation operators, they're gamma matrices. They have the anti-commutation relations of gamma matrices. And we know how big they have to be, because we know what we should do if we want to construct gamma matrices. We put them in together in pairs. We take for each one some friend, which here I just called I plus N, and we make them into pairs. And this is the dagger of this one. And these guys have the conventional fermionic annihilation and creation operator algebra, and so we know that they span a space of 2 to the number of gamma matrices divided by 2 dimensional representation. So the size of the gamma matrices in 2n dimensions is 2 to the n. There was something else I wanted to say, but I forgot completely what it was. I'm sure it'll occur to me. So that was Dirac's discovery. I'm not sure whether Clifford worked out the matrix representations of his algebra. He had a different motivation. Anyway, he died young. So let's come back to now what we know about the spectrum of the states here. If we want to write down the states, we should not write down things going down here, because they're really taking, usually the negative energy states are filled. And taking something out leaves a hole behind, and we think of that as an excitation. But that's the same here as occupying one of these positive energy states. So you don't want to double count. So we'll just leave off the branch of states that go down below. We've got something exactly at zero, which I've said has to be treated slightly differently, which is why I've drawn it as a dotted line there. 5 minutes. Okay. Oh God. All right, so what we need is we need to have put two vortices together to get one zero mode that can be occupied or not. I think I'll stand on the side and I can do it. No, my head's annoying. I want a remote control, but I don't have one. So the ground state degeneracy of the system, when we've got a certain number of vortices, we have to divide the number of vortices by two. And actually, you need to, sorry, that one should be, no, that's right, it is up there. The whole thing falls in part into boson, into two sectors, bosons and fermions, which is why you need an extra piece. So some people quote the degeneracy with a minus one here, and other people don't, because it depends whether they're counting the bosons and fermions. So from this, we can understand these fusion rules. Everybody has to write down these fusion rules. And I must admit that when I first learned about these sort of things, trying to read the big yellow book and learning conformal field theory, I found it all rather mysterious. You know, if you really want to understand these things, you have to know quite a lot about group representations. You have to be comfortable with more cyber geometric co-products and God knows what, complicated things. One of the great things about this superconductor is that you don't have to know any of that. You can understand this precisely and simply. So what you can do is imagine that we bring two vortices together and we let them talk to one another so that there's some tunneling between the two. So these are the two that we were thinking of as putting together to make one A or an A dagger. And we want to know what happens to the energy of that zero mode. There's going to be some tunneling between it. The energy is not going to be zero anymore. And we've got to have some operator that represents that. And I remember I asked my student Sakbam to go away and calculate what the splitting energy here was. And we couldn't figure out a good model that would allow us to do this calculation. But eventually he said to me, you know, there's only one possible operator, at least that it gives rise to, and it's this one. And so that's the insight. It doesn't matter. You don't really need to know what it is. You know there's going to be some splitting energy. The answer is going to look something like this. And this is exactly the thing that counts whether or not that mode is occupied or not. And so basically, you can see what happens as you bring two particles together, two vortices together. Let's imagine we've got a vortex here and an anti-vortex there. And we're worrying about these states as they begin to tunnel. So this zero energy state, which is really only one state, all of these other ones can either be occupied or unoccupied. This guy on its own can be occupied or unoccupied. It will now have energy which is getting pushed up as they come together. When the two vortices have fused, there's really no reason for them to have low energy states at all. This guy can be occupied or it can be unoccupied. And if it's occupied, it's sitting there. If it's unoccupied, it's just like that. And now when you bring the two together and it was occupied, you're left over with a single quasi-particle that's left over. And that's really the only mysterious one of those fusion rules. The statement that psi cross psi goes to one is simply the statement that two quasi-particles can disappear into the condensate because the Cooper pair is made out of two of them. And the other one is left over from the associativity of the fusion algebra. And so depending on whether this state is occupied or not, when you annihilate these two guys, you're either left with a particle or you're left with nothing. And so it's the two choices as exactly what's going on there. You can also understand the braiding through monodromy in this particular case. I wrote down the U's and V's before, assuming that the ambient phase of the order parameter was zero. But if you change it by putting a phase in here, you have to distribute the phase half and half here, so you have to take a square root. So the choice of your U's and V's, they come with a branch cut, a square cut, square root branch cut. And as you interchange two of them, one of the guys switches from being on the chi, that this is the phase of the order parameter seen by him. Here phase is zero, here it's 360. If you interchange them without crossing any branch cuts, the net effect then is to change the two modes, but one of them picks up a minus sign because it has to go through one of these branch cuts. And this is what Mr. Ivanov pointed out very nicely. So from the monodromy, we should be able to get the braiding. And this brings us back to the question that Nick was asking this morning. How do we know that the monodromy is to it? That's the paradigm that we have all the time from using the conformal field theory picture. You think that you braid these things around. We know how to calculate the braiding from the B matrices and so on. But we want to be able to be sure that there's no additional Berry transport causing, perhaps undoing that effect. And we know in the abelian case and the other interesting special case that Nick mentioned that there is no additional Berry transport. And this is another case where you can calculate the Berry phase precisely and see what's going on. So there's a little bit of technicalities here at the end. what you do is you've got the A's and A daggers which go into the unperturbed fermion field. Psi is a sum of A's times plane waves, for example. Here are the U's and V's that we solve by finding the Bogovyubov-Degen equation with, say, several vortices. They're solutions of these equations, which happen to have this symmetry. This equation implies that one by taking the complex conjugate of it. And in terms of those, you can write down the ground state. The ground state's the thing that's killed by all the B's, the annihilators of the diagonalized Bogovyubov-Degen equation. And you can see that that condition is equivalent to rewriting in terms of the A's, this condition. And it's not obvious, but this particular matrix here, which I've called S, is a skew-symmetric matrix. And this condition is satisfied by writing the state as some normalization factor times an exponential of two A daggers using this S guy. So this is the Cooper pair wave function. S is the Cooper pair wave function for a single Cooper pair, and this exponential is a coherent state of them in such a way as to give a non-zero value to the order parameter. So once you know what this is, you notice that I haven't put the normalization factor here. This is now an analytic function of the S's, and that's a nice kind of analytic matrix theory you can play around with. This is a state with a definite number of ordinary fermions. No Cooper pair fermions in here, just ordinary ones. We can look at the overlap of this Cooper pair guy with this one, and you see that it's basically the Pfaffian wave function. So that's where your Pfaffians come from. And you can calculate the Berry phase of this ground state and by plugging in and out of this, and you get something that you'd expect, the sum of all the Berry phases for the negative energy states together with a total divergence there, multiplied by a half, because you always overcount. That's perhaps not very interesting. We know that that would be an abelian fact. If I move the vortices around, there's a Berry phase because they experience Magnus forces. Magnus force is we know from Arovas and friends, and from Thallus, Au, and Niu, that represents itself as an abelian Berry phase. What we're really interested in is if we make states by using the annihilators and creation operators of the zero modes, do we get any additional Berry phase? And here you can calculate it because you've got the state that you make by putting some definite B's in here, and you know what the D's of B's are. The B's are made out of linear combinations of the A's with U's and V's. The A's are just fixed things. U's and V's vary as I move the vortices around, and as a consequence of that, the B's vary. And as a result of that, we've got some equation that tells us how they vary, and you can calculate the Berry phase. Remember, it's always the wave function and the derivative and then the wave function again. And basically, you get what you would have expected, the abelian one, and then something that comes from these additional states. But what happens here is that these are all made out of exponentially localized things. And so an object over here and an object over there have no overlap. All right? As a result of that, when you calculate the appropriate things that you've got to have here, all of these bits are zero whenever you look at the overlap of a particular zero mode, a particular zero energy state with another zero energy state. So there's no additional Berry phase as a result of doing that calculation. So we can have the conclusions then. I think the nice thing about the P plus IP superconductor is not so much that it's going to be a nice experimental system. I think the indications actually is that it's, if it exists, as it is P plus IP, and there's suggestions that the ruthenates do that, that particular system is going to be a mess to do experiments on it. Right? But what it provides a paradigm in the sense of a worked example, right, of where we can see the non-abelian statistics there, where you don't have to have read Moore and Seiberg and struggled through modular tensor categories to understand it. You can understand it by relatively primitive tools. And that's what I like about the system, and that's why I'm very grateful to Nick and Dimitri for pointing this out to us. You can understand here very clearly what happens if you bring two things together. It's not a matter of combining group representations. You can bring two physical objects together and see you've either got nothing left, which is just the condensate, or you've got a quasi-particle left. And again, you can do that with relatively simple tools. The monodromy is very easy to understand, and that's what Mr. Ivanov showed us. And we also have here that you can calculate the Berry phase and see there's no additional non-abelian Berry phase screwing us up. And so the thing that we desire that the monodromy, the explicit monodromy of the wave functions contains everything, you can see that that's the case here. And so that's all stuff. You know better than I don't know. My opinion was actually based on reading your paper and reading the old literature from the helium 3. I talked to Grisha Volovic about the attempts to see this in helium 3, and it's a matter of considerable frustration to the old helium 3 people. You know, they don't make rotated cryostats anymore, so they've lost their window of opportunity to see it. I think they would be certainly very happy if we could see it here. But I think I am not qualified to make pass a judgment on.
The core states you talked about, I probably missed the key point.
Maybe I left it out.
How do those turn into the sigma 1 and psi?
Okay, I went too fast, I think, in jumping over this. It's back here. This is what we want to understand. So in this particular case, the psi should be thought of as the quasi-particle, the Bogoliubov quasi-particle, right? And two of those can disappear into the condensate. So hence psi cross psi goes to 1. I think that's simply saying that there's a Cooper pairing. And then the sigmas, you have this system here, you want to have something in there which looks like sigma, and the vortices do that. I think that's the way, that you have these vortices, they're physical objects, not just mathematical things. They have these zero modes, and they have this fusion operation. They also do exactly what you expect to do with the edge modes. The edge modes, I didn't talk about it, but of course on a finite boundary, the edge momentum K is quantized. And if you've got a single vortex in the middle, you can see that the effective boundary conditions for the mode on the outside change. If you've got an even number of vortices in the middle, then the boundary conditions are, I've got to get this right, they don't have a zero mode anyway. If you have an odd ones, then there's a zero mode on the boundary. And so they have this feature of switching you from Neuwirth-Schwarz to Raymond, depending on what's in the middle there. So they're doing exactly the right things.
Okay,
You have to work it out. You have to write down the equation and just look at what the solutions are. It's easy. It's easy. It's just doing what we expect it to do, I think. I don't have any deeper insight than that. Reed and Green pointed out that the wave function S is exactly 1 over Z minus Z, at least large distance. And so the Pfaffian wave function I wrote down is there, Pfaffian. And so you want something that has these features and the vortex does it. So. Yeah. The calc, this is a long and vexed history. The physical interpretation of the Berry phase when you get it is going to be that it's the Magnus force from dragging the vortex around. So you've got some circulation, you're going to get an effect, and so you expect to get something that's proportional to the area. And so the bulk, the most important piece of the Berry phase that you would get should be proportional to the circulation around here and the effectively the fluid density, and it depends on the area, so it's not a topological invariant, it's not a flat connection. Right. Now, whether or not there is some additional statistical phases as a result of the fact that there's less fluid where the vortices is, again, that's a long-standing issue. In the ordinary helium-type superfluids, the density is sufficiently ambiguous that those phases don't seem to be well defined because the density falls off very slowly. In a charged superconductor, the density can't vary significantly. So, so there may well be an abelian flat connection piece, which I've not tried to calculate. The controversial thing is that a number of people have written down expressions for that Berry phase that involves summing up over all those negative energy states. And there's various ways of organizing the integral, because like any vortex calculations, you tend to meet conditionally convergent expressions. I don't know whether you know, if you actually try to calculate the momentum associated with a distribution of vortices just in ordinary fluid mechanics, the integral's conditionally convergent. You can't calculate the Magnus force that way. And it's the same problem occurs here. You have to think how you're going to arrange the sum. If you do it in what seems like a sensible way with some nice smooth cutoff, then I get the answer that it's proportional to the density, which is whatever which you're supposed to get. But of course, I know that's what I want to get. Some other people have done the calculation and claim everything comes from the zero modes, and they get zero for the calculation that I get everything from. So I'm a bit confused about that. So the point is that whatever connection you get, it's not a flat connection. It's not topological in that sense. There is a Bohmer-Horonov type Magnus force contribution. And I don't know whether you can do a proper calculation to see an abelian statistical phase.
Any other questions? Okay. No. Yes.